Hello, everyone, and welcome to our Gem Pursuit. I'm Matthew Weldon, and I'm joined in our magical and mysterious pursuit through the world of antique and vintage jewellery by my trusty co-host, Elise Ketcher. Hello, Elise.
Hello, everyone.
So, super excited about this episode today. And for people who've been keeping up to date with the podcast, you will have noticed we looked at jewellery eras before. However, when we were doing these jewellery eras in season three, there were some key things that we didn't look at. One of these was more of a movement than an era, so it didn't quite align with the series that we were doing, so we haven't dived into it until now. This movement influenced architecture, art, design, and also jewellery, and this was a worldwide movement. Elise, what are we talking about here today?
Today, we're talking about Art Nouveau.
Art Nouveau is something that, you know, if you're in the antique jewellery world, you're going to come across it. It is quite rare, certainly in the very high quality. But for me, when I think of Art Nouveau, I mean, you really got to set the scene in terms of what's going on in the world to actually that led to this movement.
Yeah, it's very interesting to me because when I think about art movements from the past, it's kind of a lot like, you know, something going viral on Instagram or something going viral on social media today, where it's today, you know, because everybody gets information so quickly and it kind of has a fleeting moment and then it's gone. Whereas during the end of the Victorian period and into the Edwardian period, we're still not quite there in terms of media getting out quickly to the people. So artistic movements have time to settle into the different Western cultures and then grow in different ways in different countries. So like Art Nouveau itself, the style looks a little bit different wherever you are. American Art Nouveau looks different. French Art Nouveau looks different. And English and Irish Art Nouveau look different to each other, but all have the same kind of premise.
Yeah. I mean, the design is like, and we know we'll talk a lot about the design and how it looks. I mean, but it's just free flowing, isn't it? Like, and it's to do with the free flowing line. And the reason why, there's obviously multiple reasons why. And I love what you're saying about how it develops differently in different areas. It makes me think about like the exact same thing happens today, but just the medium is different. So,
and it's so much faster. So it moves like because we have the technology that we do, things that go viral or things that people are really interested in or jump on, they have only a small moment. It's not like years where this is developing in different places and becomes something somewhat of a movement, which I think we miss out on a lot today because we're such a throwaway society.
It's like, are we going to get these really developed movements because that things change so quickly that you don't really have the time to develop it to different stages? It's like, you know, here's this trend and now it's gone, and here's the next trend and this one's bright and shiny.
Yeah. Like, but just to give people an idea though, like how it started, how did this particular movement start? So it's kind of convoluted, right? Because art movements are all about people coming up with thought processes kind of together and then using one strain of that to create something that kind of flows through everything. I know that sounds really convoluted in itself, but I'll explain.
That's art though. Like, yeah.
Exactly. So in 1862, this is kind of maybe a bit of the roots of how this movement begins. In 1862, the Japanese are invited to participate in an international exhibition that's happening in London for the very first time. Now, Japanese art would have been considered extremely exotic, very colorful, and techniques that they were using would have literally blown people's minds.
But think of today, I've never actually been to Japan yet. I know you have been. I know you've got the cupola fuckle, which is the Irish word for saying a few words in Japanese as well. But like in 1862, it would have been like Martians had landed. Like,
yes.
In terms of how different it was to the culture in London, you know, the Japanese prints, the woodcuts, you know, simple yet elegant interpretation of nature. So,
and also their interpretation of nature, because we're also talking about landscapes here. So our landscapes are wildly different from each other. Our climates are wildly different from each other. So the birds, the flowers, the landscapes, the colors, the techniques that were being used by the Japanese at the time were considered extremely exotic. And you can imagine also it coming to a worldwide stage. This is kind of like when you have a international exhibition, it's kind of like having Fashion Week today. It's like Fashion Week. All of the greatest designers are there. All of the greatest artists are there. And they're kind of coming together and they're saying like, you know, what's going on? What are they doing? The Japanese come and it's like, you can imagine everybody's like, whoa, like yeah. It would have been wow. So this is 1862. This has a profound effect on a lot of, not only the jewelers, but the artists of the time being introduced to Japanese art in its many forms. This fused together with the arts and crafts movement. Okay. Arts and crafts movement was kind of a movement that was like removing themselves away from manufacture and trying to create jewelry and artwork by hand again. So kind of reverting away from industrialism. So that fused together with the Japanese coming, also exotic imports coming, which included flowers. So for the first time, we're seeing things like orchids and peace lilies and, you know, these flowers that, again, would have blown people's minds, especially in Victorian times, because flowers had such a huge importance. And then also other things like archaeological digs that were happening and scientific finds, all which kind of created a perfect storm for creation. And this is really how this artistic movement happens. And it spans for a very short, bright burst of time, which was from around 1895 to 1910.
Now, I think trying to describe this style, it probably is one that lends itself to a description because it is so visual. Like what you're going to see with Art Nouveau jewelry, as we briefly alluded to, it's all about the free-flowing line. And as Elise, as you mentioned, there was this backlash against like industrialization in the late 19th century. What it comes across to me, and I don't know if it comes across like they just got fed up with mass production across the board, you know, all sorts of homewares, everything mass produced. And they just kind of thought there has to be some art to it. And, you know, this free flowing line, which really is key, like this whiplash line, what they call it, is the key to Art Nouveau. It's also a lot of images of nature. Insects was a key theme of it. And the female form was a big part of Art Nouveau. And sometimes, you know, all these elements blend together, but it is a very distinctive style.
Matthew, Art Nouveau to me is, it's such a change from Victoriana, also Georgian, where we're moving out of a sphere in jewelry and in art in this particular period where we're changing from literal imitation to almost dreamlike fantasy, or, you know, a rich fantasy interpretation of what you see a flower to be. So it's so imaginative. It's such a celebration of nature, but it's also such a celebration of imagination. And when I look at this period, I like to see things that I've never seen before or never imagined before come to life in jewelry.
It's probably a bit of a, I don't know if an acquired taste is the right word, but it's a developed taste maybe.
It's definitely an acquired taste. It's definitely an acquired taste. For me, Art Nouveau jewelry in particular really is art. So it's not something that I personally would wear. You know, I would be looking at something from the Art Nouveau period and I would want to look at it and stare at it all day, but I wouldn't want to wear it. Now that's me personally, because it's not my style, right? Everybody has their own styles, but there are certain things that I love from the Art Nouveau. One thing that you said was the free flowing line. Now, many of you are like, what the heck is a free flowing line? What is a whiplash line? Think of, and now Matthew is going to be, you know, his Irish male self is going to be chuckling in the corner, but think of the curve of a woman's body. Now, this particular style was all about celebrating the sensual lines that we can find in nature, and that includes the woman's body or the woman's hair, or, you know, the curves that you see in the sky when you look at clouds, or the movement of wings. Now, this particular line that we see is radical. It's not something that we see in any other period. And I do remember I wrote when I used to work somewhere else way back in the day, I wrote a article about Art Nouveau and I used the word whiplash, right? And I remember the person that I was working for at the time said to me, you can't use the word whiplash in jewelry. It doesn't sound nice. And I said, whiplash is a very important term in the Art Nouveau history. And he said to me, well, if you can sell a piece of jewelry using the word whiplash, then you can write it in your article. And you bet your bottom dollar every time I spoke to anybody about the Art Nouveau period, I used the word whiplash.
People are going to be looking at this jewelry so much when they turn around to look at it, they're going to get whiplash.
No, but you have to honor the period that you're talking about. And it's really important with the Art Nouveau that you recognize this particular line. It is called whiplash. It is a free-flowing line. It's a swirling line. It's the interpretation of shapes that are found in plants, women's bodies, undulation in nature.
Also, you have to take it into the context that you had Victorian jewelry kind of before this and crossing over to it. And the free flowing line, the female body, the insects, the imagination and the almost, as you said, fantasy style, you can really appreciate it in Art Nouveau as an art form, which the flip side of that is a lot of us in jewelry, you know, when you start, especially when you're starting to either collect a jewelry collection or when you're starting to work in the industry, you're very focused on metals and gemstones. Mm-hmm. But this is really a time period where, as you mentioned, you're not looking at the gemstones. It doesn't mean that they don't have very good gemstones. They do have really good gemstones in some Art Nouveau pieces, especially gemstones like, you know, that weren't so popular before, like opals. Well, obviously, using jewelry before that, they were a key piece of Art Nouveau jewelry, and they can be some of the most beautiful opals in the world. but it's how they fit into the piece. It's exactly as you said, you have to look at the whole piece and not just the gemstones.
Exactly. So one thing that we've spoken in one of the other episodes that we've had, it was the Fabergé episode and Carl Fabergé, my darling. He wanted to create things that had maybe no intrinsic value, but once they were put together and crafted into what they were, they became something of immeasurable value. And during the Art Nouveau movement, a lot of the pieces that were created with what were considered semi-precious stones or unusable stones at the time. So, you know, the use of things like horn was used, and that was considered something that was used for accessories or for buttons or for piano keys. You know, they weren't used for high-end jewelry items. And then they were used in this particular period and with amazing effect. But we also see the use of glass in many forms, but one in particular, the technique that was used was an enamel work, which is known as plique-jour. Now, plique-jour translates from French as daylight, or almost like windows, or, you know, light of day. So what it basically is like gold metal planes were used. And it was almost like the use of stained glass windows, but with gold frames in jewelry. And these were used, this particular technique was used a lot in the Art Nouveau period to create things like wings on dragonflies, which had human bodies,
yeah,
or butterflies with a woman's face, but with an insect's body, and mermaids with incredible scaling tails, or fish with a woman's head. These kinds of things were created, which you look at and you just think, wow, number one, so beautiful to look at. And then when you see them with the light, with the different lights that come through, it just adds another dimension to the jewel, and it really is just so stunning in person. And there's no other way that I can explain it than otherworldly and dreamlike.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the enamel, because it is a key part of Art Nouveau. And obviously we're talking in these episodes, we only have so much time and there's huge pieces you could talk about. And we have an enamel episode in our Dead Arts series, which would be well worth listening to. And when you're talking about the enamel, and it also made me think of, you know, obviously Art Nouveau, we're talking about the Art Nouveau jewelry. It was broader, and Tiffany & Co., a great jewelry company today, they actually set up Tiffany Studios at this time, specifically to produce one-of-a-kind Art Nouveau pieces. And they're very well known for these Tiffany lamps, which are very Art Nouveau in style, with amazing glass. I remember when we were in New York doing a show last year, we actually saw a lot of these Tiffany & Co. glass pieces in the Natural History Museum, and I thought they were super cool. So it is a broad movement, and it actually went worldwide. And I'll tell you, one thing you'll also see in Art Nouveau jewelry, and I think there's a bit of an irony in this, is that like Art Nouveau was in a way a backlash against mass production and industrialization. But one of the reasons it actually got so popular is that they could mass produce Art Nouveau medals and little pendants that got sent out and sold all over the world, and actually gave the movement a lot of momentum.
Yes.
So
that's one thing that I wanted to say as well, because we're talking about, like, you know, the partially clothed women with like flowing hair and eroticism and insects and nature, but there's also a flip side to it as well. And this is actually the pieces that I would wear, which is the gold work, the chaste gold work that you see in this period by people like Vuillez. Does a lot of griffins and dragons, but they're only done in gold work. So it's done with chased gold work and then finished off with hand carvings. And these kinds of mythical creatures are also coupled together with the profiles of women's faces. And they can be found during the Art Nouveau period as well. And those are the pieces that I would wear because I love gold work. And from a distance, a lot of these Art Nouveau pieces look like they are just natural gold. They don't look like they're, you know, that there's any kind of pattern on them. They look like a nugget of gold that's being drawn from the ground. But they're actually, when you look closer at them, you can see, oh my gosh, that's the face of a woman. And it's like amazing.
Still to come, we will share some tips if you are collecting or working with Art Nouveau jewelry, and we will also reveal our icons from this movement. But first, we have a very unique piece related to Art Nouveau, which we've added to our Instagram this week. Elise, can you tell us a little bit about it?
Of course. So on our Instagram at the moment, we have an amazing Art Nouveau piece, which typically shows the medallion work of this period. It's done in 14 karat yellow gold, which would indicate that it is an American Art Nouveau piece. And it shows the profile of a woman with flowing hair, which of course is the free flowing lines, which we've been talking about. And she is adorned by a beautiful diamond pendant around her neck. This piece from afar looks like it's textured gold, whereas it is in fact a chase medallion carved and finished by hand. It is exquisite and the perfect example of an Art Nouveau piece.
And if you look in the show notes, you will see a link to this piece on our Instagram.
Jewelry tips, Matthew.
Well, a trade tip that I would give for Art Nouveau, and I really want to, when we're thinking about these tips, or at least when I'm thinking about, I'm kind of thinking in the day-to-day work that we do, obviously we're antique jewelry dealers. You know, what's the wisdom or the rule of thumb when it comes to Art Nouveau jewelry? And that's what I kind of tried to get across for this. And I think we kind of covered it there a little bit. The first thing I would say is when you're looking at Art Nouveau jewelry, if you're looking to collect or to buy or whatever, or you're working in the trade, first of all, you got to look at it's art. You're assessing art. You're not assessing a jewel per se. You're assessing a piece of art. So you have to come at it from a different point of view. So, I mean, you know, they say Art Nouveau is designed by artisans, created by jewelers. You know, but when I'm thinking, I'm standing there in the shop, you know, and I've seen a few people actually have listened to our podcast lately and have called into the shop.
Standing in the shop.
Yeah, looking around, you know, drinking tea and a piece of Art Nouveau comes in for sale. What am I thinking? What I'm really thinking, number one, is how you described in great detail, at least, you know, the plique jour enamel. You got to check the enamel is perfect, because I've had a few ones in the past and we have a really good dealer who we work with. And I love this guy. He's great. He'll buy anything, right? He'll literally buy anything. At least, no, we won't say his name. At least knows who I'm talking about. But he loves Art Nouveau. And I remember he came in with this pendant and had an amazing black opal and it had all this enamel work around it. Really classic Art Nouveau. And the enamel was completely destroyed. And he was saying, oh, I just need to get that repaired. I'm thinking to myself,
how?
How are you going to get that repaired? Like that is, you can't get that repaired. It's like just making it from the start again. So if you see a piece, just check the enamel, because the repair, even if you can get it repaired, it's not the same.
I can't agree with you more. Enamel work is such a specialty. Right. It really is. So it's being able to look at powder and know that powder is going to come out a certain color. And and like a small deviation in the powder can actually change the color drastically. Completely. And dramatically. Yeah. Trying to match enamel is like having a handbag for 10 years that you've carried around in different temperatures, in different climates, with the sun on it in different places, and then trying to match leather to that leather that you've been carried around for 10 years. Like impossible, like impossible. So it's never going to look the same. If you're okay with that, then that's a different thing. If you're okay with it looking different, or it having a panel of different color on it, and it not look like a something that's really going to stick out to you, then that is fine. But you have to temper expectations when it comes to things like that. And it also takes away from its original beauty. So great tip. My tip is this. I believe personally, now some people will argue with me, but personally, I believe that the place for Art Nouveau is France, in particular, Paris. And when you walk around Paris, if you really walk around with your eyes open, you can see different interpretations and imaginative interpretations of an Art Nouveau movement that happened over 100 years ago that are still alive in the city. One in particular is their metro line. If you walk through Paris and you even just look at the archways of most of the metro lines, you will see Art Nouveau in their day-to-day lives of the Parisians. And that's what I would say to you. If you've never, ever been exposed to Art Nouveau and you're thinking, what's a great way for me to see any kind of Art Nouveau in real life, I would say visit Paris and walk around Paris and have a look at the metro lines, have a look at the details that you can see on the buildings. It is alive and well in the city of Paris.
Well, Elise, I might be taking you up on that offer fairly soon. we're planning to a staff trip to Paris to do a bit of research for a few projects we're working on. So yeah, no, we'll definitely be going around with our eyes open. And if you go to Paris, look, it's not Dublin, but you're going to really enjoy it.
Oh, also, the second thing that I would say to you as a tip for Art Nouveau is that it was, which we didn't mention in the style part, it was extremely rebellious. Like, imagine the prim and proper Victorians of the time wearing corsets and having like specific etiquette and all of this. And then the next moment, there's a naked lady on a brooch. It was considered extremely erotic. Be as erotic as you possibly can with this period. Like, get something that is, you know, shows risque. It all. Shows it all. If you want something from the Art Nouveau period, celebrate it properly the way that they intended, which was sensuality all the way.
Our last section on the Art Nouveau period. I hope you're enjoying this episode so far. I know I really am, because I think the more you read about jewelry and the more that you look at it and study it and collect it, you start to appreciate this more and more. I actually find myself, the longer I'm in the jewelry business, which is most of my life in some respects, I just gravitate to it more and more. You know, I like all the different eras and movements, but Art Nouveau has a special place in my heart. But we're going to pick an icon from the era. I'm going with Fouquet. Who are you going with, Lise?
No, if you're saying Fouquet, then you have to go and tell everybody everything about Fouquet first, and then I can tell you about mine. So I can blow you out of the water.
Probably true. But okay, well, Fouquet, let's talk about Fouquet. He is a French Art Nouveau jeweler, and actually predate Art Nouveau as well. You know, turned to a lot of Renaissance revival style initially in the 1870s and 80s, you know, and this is a multi-generational business. First of all, it was set up by Alphonse Fouquet, who was born in 1828, you know, and he apprenticed as a jewelry, as a jeweler apprenticeship. And in those days, you know, the old labor laws weren't what they were today, you know. And I think this is important to know that, you know, in France at this stage, as an apprentice, and I'm kind of conflicted because although he chose to go into this, Julie, it was very tough conditions. They had to work typically 14 to 20 hours a day, unbearable living conditions. There was some physical abuse, but in the end, this led to him being one of the top jewelers of a generation, right? So it's...
I mean, no, I totally understand what you're saying. And, you know, I have spoken with even jewelers from like the 1960s who grew up in the industry in the 1960s and 70s, completely different workplaces to what we see today for sure. And did have a lot of what we would consider questionable practices today, which created a very disciplined skill. This is the thing, super disciplined skill. So can we still have those disciplined skills today without
the extreme environment?
Without the controlled pressure that was placed upon these artisans. I don't think we can ever know, because the problem is today is that we don't even attempt to revive these skills because we have machines that can do jobs quicker. So, you know, it's interesting, it's strange, and it's also, I don't think, something that we can prove.
But this is like the Art Nouveau movement. It's kind of happening again today in a way. Like, what's really popular today in all the like micro breweries, artisan breads, like, you know, in the jewelry world, you know, antique jewelry is a growing area because people like the handmade elements of it. The fact that it's unique, it's crafted with skill, it's not mass produced. And I kind of feel like we could be in sort of a similar movement again after the industrialization and mass production of like the 90s and early 2000s. So, but we could have a whole podcast episode on that.
I know.
But anyway, let's just say that he definitely worked in a very tough apprenticeship, but he was naturally a very talented artist, which separated him from the work because the father, Alphonse Fouquet, while he was working, he realized that, you know, in this production job or manufacturing job, it was very low paying and he couldn't really make a huge difference. But he got his big break in 1847, where he got a position at a jewelry firm called Pinard, who was a big jewelry house at that time. The reason he got that is because they saw his designs, his jewelry sketches, and he learned from that that it was the design that was key. And again, you know, we're talking about Art Nouveau, it's design and then almost production after. So the next big step in the Fouquet family tree in history was his son coming into the business. His son came into the business in 1895 and he was called Georges Fouquet. Now, when you're looking at Fouquet jewelry, sometimes it's actually hard to tell who made it, whether it was the son or the father, because we actually have an Art Deco piece. You know, when you think of if Georges Fouquet came into the business in 1895, the piece we have is probably 1920s, but it's actually got Alphonse's hallmark on it. And this is literally like just because around the workshop, they're like, oh, we gotta put our stamp on this. And they just had like an old stamp. It's like, oh, that's Alphonse. We'll just use that. So, but it's definitely George's or Georges. It's definitely his
work.
Piece because of the timeline for it. But George was famous because he started using a lot of opals. He used a lot of enamel over chased gold. He used a lot of colored stones, which was again, typical of the Art Nouveau movement. Charles de Rossier also joined Fouquet around this time. And he was key in their design as well. A thing we'll like to hear about Fouquet as well, they were actually credited with introducing the female form into jewelry. So, well, you know, we'll thank them for that. No, but you know, they were key in that. Another thing is, and what I really love about them, and you can actually see this picture, and we'll put a link to it in the show notes, is, as we said, Art Nouveau wasn't just the jewelry, it was also the entire movement. There's a picture of their store, which you can Google and look at online. It was designed by Alphonsus Mucha, who was a name synonymous with the Art Nouveau movement, in around 1900. And if you look at the picture of their store, and again, it'll be in the show notes, it's just so, like, it's almost overwhelming, and it's so fantastic. Also in the fantastic as in beautifully designed, but fantastic as in slightly over the top. And I think that captures, you know, the Art Nouveau movement and what Fouquet was all about, both in their jewelry and the design of the store. And we're considering redesigning our store. And this picture actually gives me a lot of, you know, inspiration in terms of, like, you know, just go for it. Like, and they definitely went for it. And really, they're only considered, like, jewelry historians more or less agree, they're only second in terms of Art Nouveau jewelry to one other person. A firm. Who might that be?
You cannot talk about Art Nouveau without talking about my icon. It's impossible. And what's really interesting about my icon is that he kind of never set out to be a jeweler, really. His passion and his love was for glassmaking. But when he is coupled together with the work of glass and jewelry, he outshines everyone. And now you may have never, ever heard of the Art Nouveau period, but you for sure have heard of my icon. And his name is René Lalique. Now, Lalique is what he's usually known for, and he is known all over the world for his glasswork, probably because after 1908, he exclusively focused on glasswork. After 1908, he never made another jewel, which is incredible to me because the Art Nouveau period was still taking place. But René Lalique is a Frenchman through and through. He's born as a son of a Parisian merchant, and he studies design, and he studies in a school in Paris. He studies design. At the age of 16, he does go and work for a jeweler, very similar to Fouquet. He, like, apprentices with a very well-known jeweler called Louis Alcock. But the jeweler is still around today, very, very, very well known. However, his name today would outshine the name of those who he apprenticed with. He also goes to England, where he spends time learning at Sydenham College, and he enters numerous competitions while he's over there and wins. He returns to Paris in 1880. And then in 1884, Lalique exhibits his own jewels for the first time in the Louvre. Now, imagine that, like, 1884, you exhibit your own jewels in the Louvre. This, for a Frenchman, would have been the peak
proud
of his career.
Moment, yeah.
You know, a peak in a feather in his cap for sure. He also has a muse, an actress. Her name was called Sarah Bernhardt, which her connection with him and his creation of jewels for her almost sets his career alight, right? But if you look at some of his jewels and you look at Sarah, you'll notice that a lot of his female forms look like her. He also does a bronze sculpture of her head, and he, the way that he sensualizes her shows you how much of a muse she actually is to him. Now, most notably, what I want to say about Lalique is his mixture of fantasy with human form. We've spoken in previous episodes about the dragonfly brooch, very Lalique piece, which also is a national treasure of the world. I wouldn't just say of France, but of the world. It's a national treasure for us all. The plique-a-jour that he was able to create was envied by jewelers all over the world. And I don't think anybody has ever been able to replicate it. This was a perfect fusion of someone who had glass as their second nature and then was a trained jeweler, but also an artist. And that kind of coming together created something that was just inspired. It's not something that we can see visually today in anybody else. Like, it's impossible for all of those elements and all of these skills to come together to create what he created. And this is why he's so special. And I think he burnt himself out, to be honest. After, you know, 1884 to 1908, he created some really inspirational pieces that we look at today and we go, oh, wow, so beautiful. But the elements in each of them, the crafting of not only the jewelry elements of it, and then trying to make the glass work within it, so the enamel work within it, look beautiful, and then create carved sculptures of women out of bone or other materials, and then finish it off with another type of enamel work, because he used a lot of cloisonné. Enamel as well, which is almost like little cells that are, you know, you dig into the gold and make a little area for the glasswork to sit, and then you put the enamel glasswork in it and it's fired separately. So doing all of those elements, I think he burnt himself out, but what he created was the real peak and pinnacle of this period. And there's no other way to put it. He outshines the period. He is the period. And for anybody who wants to see his work, there is a museum, a Lalique museum. And of course, in France, there are a few pieces, obviously in the Louvre, and other museums scattered around Paris that you can go and see as well. And of course, private collections, having a piece of his is like having the cherry on top.
Well, what a movement, what a time period for jewelry. And I think it was just, there's some of the most incredible pieces that you're going to come across from the Art Nouveau era or movement. On that note, we are going to wrap up this episode about the Art Nouveau movement here. First of all, I'd like to say thank you for everyone who's listening. I really hope you enjoyed the show. Remember that we have notes on what we spoke about with links and anything else you might need in the description area of this podcast. And if you're enjoying the show, if you get a chance, we'd really appreciate a review. It just helps our podcast get seen. And the more it gets seen, the more time and effort we can put into doing more episodes and getting more research and guests on board. So we would really appreciate that if you get the chance. My thanks, as always, of course, to my trusty co-host, Elise Ketcher. Elise, thank you very much for today.
Thanks, everyone, for listening.
And of course, thank you to our podcast producer, dustpod.io. Until the next time, from me, your host, Matthew Weldon. See you all very soon.